If you enjoy this podcast, please like us on Facebook and follow us on Instagram and visit our website at lifebetweenthevines.com.
This podcast is sponsored by Release Winery. Join us as the story of this ultra-limited wine continues. Learn more at releasewinery.com.
Wine's been in my blood a long time. My parents actually started me early, and I think today, if I were to say this and I was young, they might actually be accused of child abuse of some sort. But
that's so funny, because my vineyard manager over in Sonoma once told me that if I ran into a bear, I had to throw my arms in the air, and if I ran into a cougar, then I had to roll and play dead. And then I thought, well, isn't it supposed to be the other way? And he said, oh, yes. I said, well, you try to kill me?
Discovering and tasting wine shouldn't be a homework assignment. And we believe that the people who are closest to wine have the best stories. So open a bottle.
And welcome to podcast number 481. This week we feature Jenna Davis and Julie Cooper, associate winemakers at Dumas Winery, Russian River, Sonoma. It's refreshing to see that women winemakers now have a greater presence in the wine industry. In fact, a few of our recent podcasts have been with these winemakers. The best part is, they're making some fantastic wines. Today we speak with Jenna Davis and Julie Cooper. Both are associate winemakers at Dumas Winery in the Russian River area of Sonoma. Diversity is the name of the game, and these winemakers are making their mark and telling their stories. You can hear Jenna on our Vino Lingo segment defining the term high density, as well as Julie defining the term longevity. I am on the phone today with Jenna Davis and Julie Cooper, and both Jenna and Julie are associate winemakers at Dumas Winery in Sonoma. Jenna, Julie, how are you doing today?
Hey, Ray. We're doing well. Thanks so much for having us. We're excited to chat with you today. Hi, Ray. How are you doing?
I'm very good. Thank you. I got to tell you, I'm kind of excited because from what I've read about both of you, you are both from Ohio. Is that correct?
Yes, it is. That's right, the famous winemaking region of Ohio.
Very true. I am a Cleveland boy myself, so it's a real pleasure to be talking to some fellow Buckeyes.
Cool. Midwest pride.
Yes. Oh, yeah. Yes, exactly. Although you are from the southern part of the state, but that's okay. I still accept you. I appreciate you taking the time today, so we're going to kind of, I guess, do a little bit of tag team back and forth. I'm going to go ahead and start with you, Jenna, and let's talk about your particular wine journey. What led you to get into this incredibly crazy, passionate business?
Yeah, so I'm actually one of those weirdos that came up with the idea that I wanted to be a winemaker in high school. So I used to get some laughs in Ohio when people would ask what I wanted to do, and I'd say, oh, I want to do viticulture and winemaking, just because, you know, it's not a career choice that you hear of a lot, being from Dayton, Ohio. But I knew of, it was an older sibling of a family friend, and she was from Ohio, and she was a winemaker in Napa, and I knew I loved the chemistries and microbiology, and I'd always been really into horticulture. I always worked in plant nurseries growing up in high school. And so I heard of this career of winemaking, and I was just totally, totally intrigued. And I decided, you know what, that's what I want to do. So very early on, I kind of set my eyes on it, and I actually went to Ohio State for my undergrad. I had a, you know, big family tradition of Buckeyes, so followed in the footsteps, and I did food science actually, because that was kind of the closest thing I could get to winemaking at Ohio State. And I had always kind of planned to transfer to UC Davis, but I had met my now husband, and I was quite enjoying myself at Ohio State, so I decided I would finish that degree. So I finished that degree, and then I packed up the car and I drove cross country out to Napa, and I started working harvests. And worked a bunch of harvests in Napa and Australia, and I worked at Dumas. So that's where I got introduced to Dumas, and I just loved the culture here. We work with incredible vineyard sites, and it just has a very humble, you know, down-to-earth culture here, and we work with some of the best fruit. So it's a really special place to be. And so I stayed in touch with Andy and Julie, and I decided to go back to school. So I went back and got my master's at UC Davis in viticulture and enology, and then just got really lucky, right place, right time. They were looking for an assistant winemaker when I graduated, and I've never left.
Excellent. Good for you. And how many years have you been making wine?
So just finished my 7th vintage.
Wow. Congratulations. That's great.
Yeah. And I'm the newbie on the team, so it says something. It's pretty rare these days.
Yeah. It's just kind of funny to think about going from Ohio State to Davis. It's not exactly a common combination.
No, it's not. It's funny. I tried to find anything wine-related while I was there, and I actually did some research on up in Worcester, Ohio, on cold hardiness in grapes. So they had a little branch of some viticulture research going on, which was cool, and I got into some brewing as well, get my feet wet and some fermentation. So
sure.
It's a good stepping stone.
Yeah, very good. And obviously the old saying about beer and wine, we know where that goes. Julie, tell me about your beginnings in wine and what led you down that path.
So I came at it from a very different route. I worked in restaurants for a number of years in Ohio. My background in education has nothing to do with science. I have a BA in communication with a minor in political science, and I was on track to go to law school. But when I finished with my BA, I didn't want to do any more schooling. I was done with that for now, for the time. And so I started working in restaurants, and I got really interested in food and wine from that aspect. And I was all set to explore and pursue a career as a beverage manager for a restaurant group in Cincinnati, Ohio, where I'm from. And I wanted to learn more about winemaking to increase my knowledge so I could be a better beverage manager. This was quite some time ago, so it wasn't really the highlight of the sommeliers. It was more, we were a food and beverage manager, and that's where I thought I was going. So I came out to Napa, and I lived in St. Helena, and I was working at the Culinary Institute at the restaurant there, and I met some winemakers, and I asked one of them if I could come and work harvest for him, and he sized me up. I'm not very tall. I'm a little person, and he sized me up and kind of laughed and said, sure, come on down. We'll give you a shot. So I went to his winery the next morning, and we picked some fruit that day, and we pressed the Chardonnay. And at the end of the day, as I was cleaning up, he suggested that I keep track of my hours, and he was going to go ahead and pay me. And that was my very first vintage, and that was in 1999. After that, I had to move back to Ohio for some family stuff, but I kept coming out to work for this guy for the next 4 years to work harvest for him. And after doing that for a few years, the restaurant group I was working with kind of fell apart, and I was more interested in learning about what happened with the wine after it got into the barrel and the fermentation was over. I wanted to know more about the aging of it. I wanted to know more about how you get it in the bottle. Everything else is what then I wanted to know. So I moved out here in 2003 and got a job with a female winemaker in Napa, and that's how I met Andy Smith. And I was working with him, racking some wine at this tiny cellar in Napa, and he said he was looking for an assistant winemaker, and maybe I should apply for that job, which I promptly did, and I've been working with him ever since. So that's how I got here. So I've been with Dumal since 2004, and that's a really long tenure at a winery for someone who's not an owner or the principal winemaker. But it's always been a really exciting, challenging place to be. There's always new things happening. As Jenna said, we've always worked with some of the very best fruit that you can get your hands on and some of the very best farmers that there are. So that's my story. And I've really loved my career in winemaking. It's been a lot of fun. It's been very educational. It's just been terrific.
What's really nice to see in this industry is the change that there are so many women as winemakers and different parts of the industry, too, than there were
20, even 10 years ago, it's a big change. And it's in my mind, a very positive change because I think some degree women bring a bit of a different touch to the table. Is that reasonable to say? And I'll throw that to either one of you.
I would agree with that. I do think women taste wine differently than men. You know, some people say they're better. I don't really think it's better. I just think we're different. I do think we have a different approach to how we deal with people and how we craft the wine, how we deal with the grapes. That's what I think. What do you think, Jen, as a newer than I am to the industry?
Yeah, I mean, I had it much easier. You know, huge thank you to the, you know, last generation of women who really opened the door for us, making it, you know, a career option and something that you think of that you can do. And I think, back in the day, it needed maybe more just brute strength to lift things and move things. But in this day and age, we've got forklifts, we have things, so a woman can do anything in the cellar. And, you know, there's just as many instances where being small and being able to slip between barrel rows and this and that comes in handy. So I think it's something that's really improved, but something that can continue to increase the amount of women that are, you know, owners of wineries and, you know, continue to get women promoted. So there's still more to do, but I think it's been a great move to see the increase of women winemakers for sure.
Yeah, that's great. So, Julie, tell me, I want to backpedal for a second about the winery that you went to work for in the cellar in Napa. Who was that?
So that was Pam Starr, and I worked with her on the 2002 and 2003 vintages. And I had met her. She hired me sort of sight unseen. I was recommended to her by another great female winemaker called Sarah Gott. The very first winery I worked for was called El Molino, and I worked with a guy called Reg Oliver there. And after I would finish, he had a very small production. So after I would finish with him, the first year he introduced me to Niels Vangate. So I did a little bit of work for him at Saddleback.
Nice.
And then following years, I was introduced to Sarah Gott. So I did some work for her when she was the winemaker at Quintessa. And when I decided to come out here full time, she was gracious enough to help me craft my resume and pass it around to some of her winemaking friends. And Pam Starr was looking for an assistant winemaker at the time to help her with her own project, Crocker and Starr. And then she was also the winemaker at Adastra and Risto Estate at that time and the consulting winemaker at Gemstone. So she hired me to help her out with those projects. And it was through her that I met Andy Smith. So it was all very much, you know, Jenna said this as well, right place, right time. I got really lucky to get my foot in the door at a good time and with some really good people, not having any education in winemaking or experience. And then it was just up to me to take that and run with it, which I did.
Sure, clearly.
And I really enjoyed working with her, and I learned a lot from her.
Yeah, I'm not surprised. Pam is about wine education, and she is truly passionate, and she's one darn fine person, so kudos. And as a quick aside, if you check out our website, you should go look up a couple of her interviews. In the last 14 years, I've interviewed her more times than I think I can count, and she's always fun to hang out with, too, so there you go.
Awesome. That's the fun thing about the wine industry. You know, it's so international, but it's such a small industry at the same time, too, so...
It really is. Well, I think it's time we move on to talking about the wine. And I'm going to drop in one quick caveat as we go. I'm strictly trying to recognize your voices by the sounds. So if I miscall somebody by their name, please forgive me, okay?
No worries.
I'm looking for absolution right up front here. So Jamal is in the Russian River Valley, and obviously some incredible Pinot Noir and Chardonnays come from that area, as many different areas of Sonoma. But you're also doing Cabernet and other wines. Can either one of you tell me about some of the other wines you're making? We'll come back to Pinot and Chard in a minute.
Yeah, so we're a majority Pinot Noir and Chardonnay house. But we also make some other varietals, which is really fun. So we make a little bit of Syrah, a little bit of Cabernet Sauvignon, and then we just planted in 2016 at our estate vineyard a couple rows of Chenin Blanc and a Spanish grape called Mencia. So we dabble around in some other varietals that keeps it interesting for us. And, you know, we only do it when we find really special sites that we're really excited about. But we're still predominantly, you know, Pinot and Chardonnay.
What made you want to get into Mencia? I'm curious.
You know, so Andy has a theory, which I really love, which you don't really have an opportunity very often to get to plant a vineyard. And so when you do, you should do something special. You know, you should push the boundaries in some way or the other. And when we, for example, when we planted our estate vineyard, we did a very high density planting. And when we planted this new kind of parcel, we decided, well, let's do, you know, there's pressures of climate change and just learning different grape varietals. So let's take the chance to kind of see what some different grape varietals do. So none of us were terribly familiar with the grape, but we knew it grew well in kind of that northwest area of Spain, and it was very tolerant to climate change, and we thought it could do really well here. So we planted it, and so far it's been making absolutely delicious wine, so we're pretty excited about it.
Well, and Spanish wines are very special, in my opinion. So this question I'm gonna pose to Julie. What's the most unusual grape that you've worked with, or a couple of grapes?
Oh, for me, I would have to definitely say the Mencia is the most unusual grape I've worked with. We picked Nebbiolo for a couple of years, and that was fun to play around with as well. It looks so much different in the vineyard than other grapes. And it was kind of interesting to wrap your head around. Unfortunately, that vineyard was up, has been pulled out, so we don't get to take that fruit anymore. Over the years, we've made Viognier too, which isn't a super unusual grape variety, but it is a rather difficult grape to make into wine. It's tough to grow it, and it's tough to make a well-balanced Viognier. And we did it for about 20 years, 15 years. And that was a lot of fun. We've stopped making that. We've done our last vintage of Viognier, so we've kind of played that one out, and we're moving on. I've made a little Zinfandel over the years, but most of my career has been here at Dumal, so I'm pretty solid in Pinot and Chardonnay production.
Sure, and that makes sense for that area. Let's talk about your vineyards and the locations. You were referring to estate. I'm assuming you not only have estate, but you also lease or buy grapes elsewhere?
Yeah, it's a pretty special spot in the fact that everything that we work with, we either planted, it's our estate, or we farm, or it's been a relationship with a really special grower that we've had for 20 plus years. So we're intimately involved in all of our farming, and we do have about 60 acres now of estate property as well. And a majority of our vineyards are kind of focused around this Green Valley. It's like a sub-AVA of the Russian River Valley. So
sure.
It's kind of in the extreme southwest corner of the Russian River Valley. It's got more kind of rolling ridge tops. So you've got a lot of interesting kind of aspects. And it's the first area that the fog kind of sucks in from the San Pablo Bay. It's kind of the last area that it burns off. So it's a bit cooler than the Russian River Valley and makes really expressive Pinot Noir and Chardonnay. So we like to call it kind of the tenderloin of the Russian River Valley. So a majority of our vineyards are around this area.
Now, I'm curious between the two of you, if this is kind of a two-part question, and again, either one of you can take it. One is, do you belong to a tasting group that could either be winemakers or could be non-winemakers? And do you do them as a group of women, or is it simply mixed? How do you go about that? Assuming you do that.
I have two small children right now. So when I was had less going on in my personal life, I was part of a tasting group, a couple different tasting groups over the years. And they've been a mix of you know, with men and women, and then I was in one that was just with women. I kind of prefer a group that has more diversity. So I like differences in palettes. So I like to be with men and women. I like people that make different varieties. I think you learn more that way. So that's what I would say about tasting groups. I think they're great. And like I said, I think I like a group that has a lot of diversity.
Yeah, I'm also in some tasting groups. Most of mine are different people that I went to school with, which not only is this a great way to stay in touch, but it's always everybody's, you know, obviously very passionate about wine. So I'm in a couple different little groups, and I agree with Julie. Yeah, it's nice. It's a mix of men and women, you know, different ages, different areas around here, you know, making all types of different types of wine. So it's really fun, and it's important to get together and keep tasting different things. So it's a fun piece and an important piece for sure.
And I'll just say one other thing, because I've been in groups that have been all winemakers, and then I've also been in groups that include people in other aspects of the industry, in sales of wine or sales of barrels or other things like that. And I think that's a really interesting place to be too, because then you have different palates. It's not just all trained technical winemaking palates. It's palates that are geared towards selling stuff. And I think that's a lot of fun to bring in, and you can learn a lot from those people as well.
That's for sure. And sometimes we'll have people that are not winemakers in the tasting group, and they're always, oh, what you guys talk about is so different. Because, you know, in the tasting group, when you're all winemakers, you analyze the wine of, you know, you're talking lees aging and, you know, barrel breakdown and the vineyard site, the soils, you know, you go down this path of winemaking, thinking of it all through the lens of how the wine was kind of crafted, rather than sometimes taking that winemaking hat off and just enjoying and tasting the wine through a different lens, for sure.
That's a really interesting point. I'm going to go out on a little bit of a limb here and make a reasonable comparison. Tell me what either of you think of this. Professionally, I'm an audio engineer, and we often talk about sound. There are people who feel them; they are audiophiles, that kind of thing. But I was in education for a period of time, and the one thing we talk about is audio engineers do not have better ears. They listen differently. And I'm thinking about when you're talking about sitting in a group of people who are, for lack of a better word, civilians versus winemakers or even salespeople in the industry. Is it fair to say you're sort of in that of that same opinion, that you're looking as a professional very differently at what you're tasting versus someone like me?
For sure. I mean, I think it takes a while, especially if you go to, like, you know, school for wine things. It takes a while to not. It's hard not to just look at a wine and analyze it for faults. You know, you look at it, does it have Brett? Does it have VA? You know, you kind of go down this list of looking for faults because you're trained to make wine that doesn't have faults. And, you know, so it's hard sometimes to not allow yourself to go down those paths and just taste the wine as a wine. So it's definitely, I definitely agree with your statement there.
Yeah, I think so too. And I think as winemakers, just like you said, as in your profession, your ears aren't necessarily better. You don't hear better than other people. You hear differently, and you're trained to hear differently. And you also probably have a different lexicon to speak about what you're hearing, which we have as winemakers too. We've been training to taste wine differently, and we've also been training to express how we taste it and what we taste. Where other people may not have the vocabulary to say things, but they're really good tasters. They just don't know the words to express it yet. And that's what you learn as a winemaker. You spend years and years learning how to express what you're tasting when you're tasting a wine.
Sure. And maybe some people don't want to learn those words, but they want to be able to relate to them and maybe be correct in identifying something, which brings me to the dumb question here. All tasting groups I've been involved in have always been blind. I'm assuming you do blind tastings, or do you not as well?
Yeah, usually they're blind. Yeah, so there's a common thing where, you know, if you do a quick get-together, everybody just brings a bottle, and it's all blind, and you rotate tasting each other's blind bottles. And then if your group has their their stuff together. You know, someone will actually host and put together a thoughtful lineup of wines. But yeah, it's pretty much always blind. I prefer a blind tasting as well because it takes out the prejudice. When you have a producer that you really like, you know, everybody has producers they really like. You want to like their wines when you taste them, so you are always saying good things about them. And when you taste blind, you take that out. So it really just relies on what your actual palate tastes, and it can be very enlightening. Some producers that you think you don't like, you end up really liking that wine because you don't have that prejudice.
Yeah, that makes a great deal of difference. It's more of a fun way too when you're guessing. So we're talking about the Russian River and you know, an area, Sonoma in general, well known for Pinot and Chardonnay, which I love. But I'm also a big Cabernet drinker, and this is just my personal opinion. I've drank a lot of Napa Cabernet and a lot of Cabernet for other areas. But to me, there's a real difference between Sonoma Cab and Napa Cab. Maybe I'm reaching. Any thoughts on that?
No, they're vastly different, yes. When we started making Cabernet in 2014, it had a lot to do with the head winemaker here, Andy Smith, and he had a relationship with various wineries in Napa, and those had all dissolved. So it opened the door for Dumal to make Cabernet. So we source vineyards in Sonoma, and we also source vineyards in Napa. And the cabs that we make from the valleys are so vastly different. Now, I will say our Napa cabs are also quite different from a lot of other Napa cabs because they're made with a Dumal style, and they come from some of the cooler areas in Napa Valley. But without a doubt, the areas in Sonoma that grow Cabernet, they're not, I think a lot has to do with the weather and the soil, and I think also some has to do with maybe the Pinot influence of a lot of producers here, and so they probably take a slightly different approach to the making of the wine.
Yeah, and when we decided, because Andy had made and consulted in Napa for a long time, so we wanted to, you know, use that experience he had and then also the connections he had to some really cool sites. So I would say, true to Dumal and all that we do, we're a vineyard up approach. So we've really kind of found these unique sites for Cabernet, both in Napa Valley and Sonoma. So we have, you know, a little less classic sites. They're in Coombsville, which is cooler, and up on Spring Mountain, where you get, you know, that mountain Cabernet texture. And then our Sonoma site is one of the oldest Cabernet sites. It was planted in the 60s, and, you know, it's dry farmed, and it's up on Moon Mountain. So they're all very unique sites that make very expressive, kind of terroir-driven Cabernet. So they're a little less typical, I would say. They're a little more nuanced, a little more elegant, and for sure the Sonoma stands out different than the Napa Valley. But they're all their own unique Cabernet, for sure.
I think Cabernet Sonoma is less overtly fruity, and it has a lot more of the secondary savory characteristics. There can be some greenness to it and a lot of minerality, which I think makes for a really exciting, sexy, and very food-friendly wine.
These are great descriptors for this. You mentioned some of my favorite places for Cabernet, too, which is really cool. I'm going to kind of switch directions just a little bit here. The subject I'm sure you've talked about many times and maybe you're tired of, maybe not. You know, climate change is a big issue. It's certainly a big issue for anybody in agriculture and especially in the wine industry. What do you see for the future in terms of what you're growing? Do you have those major concerns, and do you see maybe a shift in what you'd end up growing in the future?
There's no doubt, you know, climate change is impacting us. I mean, our bud break happens weeks earlier. We're harvesting sometimes almost like a month earlier. You know, it's significant. So it's definitely impacting, but we have a couple really great things going for us, which one, just as a whole as an industry, you know, we're farming vines, which are, they're pretty hardy things. So that's a nice thing. So we've got vines, and then the areas that we grow grapes in that Green Valley pocket gets nice rains, and it has a lot less kind of water shortage pressures, which is really great. So typically we don't have to irrigate our vineyards at all, which is really special. And all of our vineyards are now mostly 15 plus years old. So they're established, their roots are deep, and they don't really need much water. So we're sitting in a really lucky, pretty spot with where most of our vineyards are, with our vine age. So we're not, you know, there's no immediate concern, but it's something that you always need to think about. And, you know, we've planted some Mencia, and we'll keep experimenting around with different varietals. But for now, it seems like our vineyards are established, our soils are healthy, and, you know, I see still a bright, long future for that area.
I do, just going on with what Jenna's been saying, you know, climate change definitely is very serious. It's here to stay, and we have to work with it. And I think a lot of people are doing that with, when they get the opportunity to plant a vineyard, how they're planting. And there's much different choices in the rootstock that you're using and the rootstock and variety and what you're pairing together than you might have made 10 years ago when we didn't have to worry so much about the increasing temperatures and the lack of water. So there is definite things that people are doing in the vineyards to work with climate change. And there's also a lot of technology that's happening in the vineyards to work with climate change as far as, you know, battery-operated tractors and things like that. People are always working on stuff like that as well, which is super important.
I'm a little curious for your area, if you're running into issues with labor. Everybody in the country is running into labor issues, but it certainly has been affecting the wine industry for quite some time. What is it like for you, both whether it be in the vineyard or in the cellar?
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely been a challenging past couple years with getting harvest in turn. So once we get busy August, September, October, we always bring on six or so extra people to help us in the cellar when we're really busy making all the wine. So typically, we like to get a very international team. Just we've all worked internationally, and so it's just it's a really special experience that we want to give other winemakers as well. We want them to come here, fall in love with Sonoma, and, you know, have a really great experience making wine here. So typically, we have quite an international harvest team. In the past couple years, we've hired these amazing winemakers to come over here, and with actually with COVID restrictions and visas and embassies being closed, they haven't been able to come over here. So the past two vintages, we actually had to scramble a little bit and get some local people to come help us, and that has actually been really amazing as well. So, for example, in 2020, we got a bunch of people, sommeliers and different restaurant people that were, you know, furloughed or laid off because of restaurants closing, and they did a fantastic job. We had a great harvest, and so we've managed and we've gotten through, but the challenge is definitely there. And, you know, in the vineyard as well, we're lucky that we have been working with some of the same crews for a really long time, so we've got kind of an established crew in the vineyard and really great resources there. But it's definitely getting more expensive, and with sloped vineyards and things, you know, everything is done by hand, and it's really hard work. And, you know, the people deserve more money, and it's definitely a changing environment. So the challenges are there. We've been able to kind of squeak by, but it's every year, you know, it's a challenge to make sure you have enough people in the vineyard to get everything done. It's a lot of meticulous little handwork. So,
do you think you'll be at a point, and obviously this wouldn't work for most mountainside fruit, but that you would get to mechanical harvesting at all?
No, I don't think for us personally. You know, I think it's something as an industry for vineyards that are set up with it, with nice wide spacing on flat ground. You know, they've done the research, and they say that there's not a quality difference. So, you know, hopefully as an industry, we can start doing that more in the vineyard sites where it makes sense to open up labor for, you know, the tougher vineyard sites that just need to be handpicked. So
I think there's been great improvements in mechanical harvesting, but not quite there for what we're looking for.
Yeah, I agree with Jenna. It just from a practical standpoint, you just simply can't use those machines in most of the vineyards that we source our fruit.
Sure, that's completely understandable. My favorite question is just a fun question, so I'm going to pose it to each one of you individually, and I'm going to go ahead and start with you, Julie. Obviously, you've spent some time in this industry, and I'm sure you've done plenty of media and interviews. What is the one question that you've not been asked that you would like to be asked?
Oh, I have no idea. Sorry, you really put me on the spot. People don't often ask what you do after harvest, you know, to sort of get back to normal. When you get into harvest, your entire life changes 100% because harvest takes up everything. You spend all of your waking hours at the winery. You don't see your family anymore. You don't see your dog anymore. You don't see friends. You quickly slip in and out of the grocery store just out of necessity. It really is all-encompassing. And it takes a while to bounce back from that and to get yourself back into society and back into your life. And I don't think anybody really realizes what a shift harvest is for a winemaker. I know my family even doesn't really get it, and I've been doing this for so long, that you go to work before it's light out and you come home after it's dark, and you don't eat dinner. You just get home and you can barely shower and get into bed before you have to get up again in 5 hours and come do it all over again. It's a really crazy time, and it takes a while to get back to normal from that. You know, you have to take a little bit of time off to breathe and go for walks and reintroduce yourself to your partner and all sorts of stuff like that. And I think it's a super exciting time, and I know for me, and I think for a lot of winemakers, it's what draws you in. It's the all-encompassing focus with everybody has the same goal at the end of the day, to make the best wine they could make, and you do everything you can do to make that happen. And then after that, it takes a while to decompress and return to a normal human being.
Yeah, I definitely second that. I always feel like after harvest is over, time goes so slow. You know, you're at your house and you're like, I've got a whole morning. I can just drink coffee and relax. And, you know, time seems to be going so slow because you're not just going with harvest. And it is a crazy experience that, you know, you really can't understand until you've done it. I've heard it harvest related to being on a pirate ship, which I really like. You know, you've got this little crew of people, and it's hard physical work, and you're wet and you're dirty, and you know, you got to do it till the job's done. And it's a thrill, though. Mm-hmm. It's a thrill.
You're tired, but you're exhilarated at the same time. So you don't stop because you just can't. I can remember one time calling one of my sisters, and it was towards the end of harvest, and we left early. So we left at 5 o'clock that day. And I was like, yeah, it's great. We only worked a half day. And she was like, it's a 5 o'clock. But, you know, it's just great. And as I said earlier, I have two small kids now, so my life has changed a bit. And I'm not really a part of that all-in harvest because I just can't be anymore. And I miss it a lot in a lot of ways. It's a really exciting time. And, it's great.
And I think that's, like, also a kind of the draw of winemaking. Just there's not very many careers left out there these days where you're really crafting something. And to get the chance to see something full circle from before it's, you know, it's a bud on a vine, to follow that all the way through until you actually, and you're physically doing the labor and making all the decisions to get that from that little bud on a vine all the way through to a finished bottle that, you know, you get to open up and share with people. It's, you know, it's pretty special and pretty unique these days to get to craft something like that from start to finish. So it's a super intriguing career, and it's hard work, and you know, it takes a lot of time and a lot of years to really get it and be be good at it, but it's extremely rewarding, and there's just a never-ending list of things that you can dive deeper into, whether it's soil or barrels, and it's just you never stop learning, so it's kind of addicting in that way.
And certainly not to belittle other fermentations, you know, making beer or distilling or anything like that. But with wine, you get one shot, and it takes a long time to make a bottle of wine. It's not just brewing some beer over the weekend. Mm-hmm. You know, you start in January or February with pruning the vines, and it's a full, you know, 9-10 month cycle before you pick that fruit. And then there's another 2 years before that goes into the bottle. There's a huge amount of time that goes into making a bottle of wine, and you just get the one chance at it. So it's exciting, and it's nerve-wracking, and it keeps us up at night, but it's also what keeps us getting up every day, too.
And it's tied to agriculture, you know. It's not just buying some products and mixing up a recipe, you know. You're at the mercy of Mother Nature, which is another part of the thrill, I guess.
Yeah, there are aspects you have absolutely no control over, and all you can do is react. You try as hard as you can to prepare and to be ready, and you read the weather forecast, but there's no guarantee that that's going to come to fruition. So sometimes you simply have to react, and you have to react fast.
Excellent answers, both of you. That was good. Thank you. For our listeners who would like to learn about Dumal, and either one of you can go for this one, what is your web address?
It is www.dumol.com.
Excellent. You did that well. Jenna, Julie, thank you both very much for taking the time. A real pleasure to talk to, again, a couple of fellow Ohioans, and thanks for taking the time. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thanks so much. It was fun. Thanks for having us.
Learn more by visiting dumol.com. Thanks for listening to the longest-running wine podcast online. Subscribe to the podcast at lifebetweenthevines.com or sign up to our YouTube channel. You can also follow us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. Life Between the Vines comes to you from Fifth Floor Recording Company in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Produced and edited by Ray Pfister. Our host is Kay Paskoff. Our web geek is Dan Gieschen. Our intern is Clement Maddox. Original music by Ray Pfister. Copyright 2022.